From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we examine the homicide rates in Michigan's cities. What do the 2012 crime stats tell us about those cities?
The number of drive-by shootings, the number of incidents with gun violence is substantially up from where it would have been 20 or 30 years ago.
Plus, Senator Debbie Stabenow talks to us about the new farm bill she'll try to push through Congress again.
We just keep extending these old policies that cost a lot of money and don't work.
And what will tomorrow night's State of the State speech tell us about the real Rick Snyder?
He has a fairly appealing brand that goes back a long ways in the state. And the question is, do people still buy that brand?
We've got those stories and much, much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder delivers his third State of the State address tomorrow evening. So on today's show, we get a preview of what he's likely to say and not say. And 2012 crime reports are in. Detroit, Grand Rapids, Lansing, Flint, all cities broke or tied their homicide records. We'll ask what's behind the increase and what can be done to stop it. But first, Senator Debbie Stabenow is asking the state's farmers and leaders in agriculture to push Congress to pass a new farm bill. Stabenow spoke to the Michigan Agribusiness Association at its annual conference earlier this morning in Lansing. She chairs the Senate Agriculture Committee, and she joins us now. Senator Debbie Stabenow, welcome.
Well, it's good to be with you.
Good to have you with us. So the Senate was able to pass a new farm bill in 2012, and with a surprising show of bipartisan support, but it stalled out in the House. And now you're hoping to take up a new bill in February or March. So what do you think? Is this bill ever going to get signed into law?
Well, it will, because our farmers and ranchers need the certainty of a five-year farm bill and knowing what the policies are going forward. And consumers need to know their choices are, and our farm bill includes more investments in local food systems and choices and healthy fruits and vegetables and farmers markets and so on. And it's got to, because when we look at the deficit we have today, we need to find ways in a smart, common sense way to cut spending. And we did that in our farm bill. We cut subsidies that have been going on for a long time for farmers that don't need them, frankly, big farms down the south that have high prices that have been getting a government check every year. We eliminated that. We saved $24 billion altogether. And we moved agriculture towards the future. And so it's got to get done. It was very concerning to me that at the end of the year that the House, rather than take up the bill, which has never happened before, that the House has not taken up a farm bill when it was due. But instead, there were some backroom dealings, and folks ended up just extending the current policy in order to continue the big subsidies. So we're going to push back on that this year, because the forces that want to continue those are going to find that there is not the support to do it.
Help someone, Senator Stabenow, who doesn't really quite understand what the farm bill is, to understand it. It really has major effects on all parts of the nation's economy, doesn't it?
It really does. And, you know, just starting from a Michigan standpoint, we have almost one out of four Michigan jobs that are connected to agriculture or the food industry in some way. 16 million people work in America because of agriculture in some way. So the farm bill is a jobs bill, first of all, and it covers a wide range of things. One piece of it is how to support farmers in being successful when there's a problem through something called crop insurance or other support to sell their products, research on pest and disease control, and so on. Michigan State's very, very involved as a leader in that. So there's a range of things for farmers and ranchers. We also have the largest investment in preserving our land and our water through what's called the Farm Bill. It's a conservation title, which protects runoff, for instance, into the Great Lakes. One of the things I'm proud of about the Farm Bill that we've passed is that there's a major new Great Lakes initiative that would deal with pesticides and erosion and other water quality issues in the Great Lakes. So conservation, protecting open spaces for hunting and fishing and our, you know, open spaces on forests and so on, all part of the Farm Bill. Energy title, which not only focuses on biofuels, but a new great opportunity for Michigan called bio-based manufacturing, where we're using byproducts from corn and wheat and other products to make offset chemicals that are in manufacturing. So those are jobs for us. And then the whole area around school nutrition, supporting our fresh fruits and vegetables, our fruit and vegetable industry, very important in Michigan, called specialty crops, and making sure we've got healthy foods in schools is also a part of this, and the broader nutrition programs for families. So it covers everything. Whether you are in farming or not, all of us eat. We have the safest, most affordable food supply in the world, and it's done. You know, this is in part because we have had a broad set of policies to support American agriculture.
So you want to reintroduce in February or March. How are you going to get this through, and how are you going to avoid what happened at the end of last year with the backroom logjam and it got killed? How do you want to change your tactics this year?
Well, I just met today, in fact, with Michigan agricultural leaders talking about how we need to redouble our efforts to get the Michigan House delegation engaged. We have some prominent members not chairing committees that we really need to take up the cause and champion the right kind of bill for Michigan, the right kind of policies for Michigan. And we will pass a bill in the Senate again, as we did before, on a bipartisan basis. It will save dollars and create the right policies. But we're going to need more and more people getting involved to really push and advocate in the House that they not just stick with these old policies that we can't afford, that don't work, you know, these big subsidies for folks that don't need them, rather than focusing on crop insurance and help when farmers do need it.
I want to shift a bit now our conversation over to the state of agriculture here in Michigan, and to kind of remind those folks who are city dwellers and think of manufacturing first, how important agriculture is in our state.
Oh, it's very important. As I said, it's just about one out of four jobs. It really touches everything for us. I mean, if you're in a city and going to the grocery store, you're affected by agriculture in Michigan. If you like to go to the farmers markets and get your fresh fruits and vegetables and support local growers, you're certainly affected. If you like to hunt and fish and have beautiful open spaces in Michigan or swim in our waters, I mean, you're affected by the conservation policies that happen through agriculture. I mean, 70% of our land is owned by somebody in Michigan. Yeah. And so that those policies that affect what happens in conserving the land, how we manage our from a forestry standpoint, how we keep open spaces that we can all enjoy, all of those things are done in conjunction with farmers, ranchers, those that manage the land. So everybody's affected by this. And as I said, we also are very involved in efforts to make fresh fruits and vegetables available in schools, to make nutrition programs available for families when they need help, for our senior citizens when they need help as well. And all of that is part of our food and farm policy.
You touched, Senator Stabenow, on the specialty crops and also the kinds of events that can hit them. And certainly we saw that last spring here in Michigan with that freakish warm-up, and then it froze again and really hit, like, cherry and apple crops very hard. How concerned are you for the state's economy in terms of these crops?
Well, I'm very concerned, first of all, just about the weather patterns across the country and around the globe. They are changing, and as we see warmer climates, it interacts with storms. It makes storms more intense. Sometimes it shows up in freakish cold weather, sometimes hot weather, but we are seeing changes that are having more and more of an effect in general on disasters, but certainly for our farmers. And last year we were very hard hit, as you know. It warmed up February, March, got cold again in April. The buds on the trees thought it was spring, and so cherry buds came out, apples, grapes, and then we lost virtually in our entire cherry crop, and most of our apple crop, about 60% of our grapes in Michigan. And so I'm very concerned that not happen again. When I look at this weather, it's nice to look at some warm weather in January, but I look at it through the eyes of agriculture now and get very worried that we're going to see this kind of thing happen again. And we can't, most of our growers are small, medium-sized operations, and it's devastating for them. And ultimately, becomes devastating for all of us as consumers when we're trying to, go to the store and get all the wonderful produce that we love and benefit from in being such a great agricultural state. Prices go up, and it causes real havoc. So that's why I tell folks that you know, there's no more risky business than agriculture. And nobody else has to pay attention to the weather, which is beyond their control. So it is important to have things like insurance available, crop insurance available. And in places where we've had adequate crop insurance, folks were protected from the weather changes. But unfortunately, a lot of our fruit growers don't yet have that. And so that's one of the real priorities for me in the Farm Bill.
And let's just ask, what happens if you can't get that new Farm Bill passed? Do you have an extension of the previous bill? What happens?
Well, the concern that I have is that if we don't get something done the next 9 months, and then the people fighting reform and spending reductions get another extension, we just keep extending these old policies that cost a lot of money and don't work. So we've got to figure out a way to get that done and hold the folks accountable in the light of day for for the fact that they're supporting these subsidies. This was a last-minute deal with Senator McConnell, who had voted against the Farm Bill and was representing those interests. And we've got to make sure that we have accountability and transparency. Folks are going to have to stand up and explain how they are supporting subsidies that are indefensible.
Senator Stabenow, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside. We look forward to talking with you again.
Thanks very much. Good to talk to you.
Still to come, the media has descended upon downtown Detroit for the press preview days of the North American International Auto Show. In 20 minutes, we'll discover what trends are coming out of the show and what they mean for consumers. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The just-completed old year was not a good year in Michigan's big cities, not when it came to murder. 2012 crime reports are in. Detroit, Grand Rapids, Lansing, and Flint all broke or tied their homicide records. Here to take a closer look at murder levels, homicide levels in Detroit, is Dr. Greg Barrick. He's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Eastern Michigan University, and the mayor of Flint, Dane Walling. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Greg, I want to start with you. The nationwide murder rate has significantly declined over the past couple of decades. So why are so many of Michigan's major cities running in a different direction?
Well, if I could begin by putting it in perspective, homicide rates across the country are down to about 4.8 per 100,000. In the Midwest, it's even lower at 4.5. Here in Michigan, the state as a whole is at 6.2. If you went to Detroit, it's 8 times higher than that at a range of about 53. Now, having said all of that, Detroit and Michigan has been fairly stable or constant in their rates over the last decade or so, and significantly down from 8 or 9 as a mean or an average in the 1990s. But I didn't answer your question, mm-hmm. which was what accounts for higher rates. I'm not all that surprised in terms of Detroit. Its rate today is no higher than it was when we were identified as the murder capital of the world. Mm-hmm. And for 20 or 25 years, both Flint and Detroit have competed for that dubious honor, you might say. Now you're dealing with a city in crisis. You're down to a population less than half of what it was. You have a concentration of what we could call increasing immiseration or poverty. You have people who are feeling trapped. Mm-hmm. Is that enough of an answer?
It's quite a prescription. Mayor Walling, Flint saw 66 homicides last year, and that appears to have matched the record number of killings in 2010. So I'm wondering, what kind of conversations have resulted in Flint City Hall from this?
Well, there's been great concern all across the community. I would add to what the professor shared around the situation with Detroit and Flint and population decline and socioeconomic factors. One of the things that we see is that almost all of our homicides involve guns. They involve firearms, illegal guns. And when you take a look at what's happening with the rate of gun violence, not only those instances that result in homicides, but shooting victims across the country, not just in Michigan. There are many, many more. I think estimates have shown approximately 50% more shooting victims or gun violence victims than there would have been 10 or more years ago. So there's a prevalence of deadly weapons. There's a prevalence of violence. And that's, in my view, adding to the difficulties around the traditional socioeconomic challenges.
Let's look at Flint, since we have you, Mayor Walling. We're not talking about the entire city, are we? We're really looking at hot spots within your city, aren't we?
There are a number of neighborhoods that are being affected by gun violence and the homicides. You can point to those on the map, but I can tell you that if you take a broader view and you look at the number of incidents that have taken place over the last 4 to 5 years, and we're working with the FBI and the Safe Streets Task Force, of course, the Michigan State Police that has a strong presence here, disturbing challenge is that the number of violent criminal incidents are taking place in a large number of the city's neighborhoods. So it is a challenge that we consider to be a citywide challenge. There's certainly neighborhoods that are safer. There's neighborhoods that regularly experience gunfire, on the other hand. The way I think about it as a regional or statewide problem is not so much that the prevalence of violence is on every street, but that our policies and our decisions that are affecting these matters are being made, in many cases, outside of city government control. So when the state of Michigan decides to make changes to their revenue-sharing formulas of the sales tax dollars that have traditionally funded police and fire departments and uses that for other purposes, then you see across the board in Michigan, I believe we're down 16% fewer total police personnel than we had 10 years ago. So those are the statewide dimensions of this challenge as I see it.
We actually talked last week to the executive director of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police, very, very concerned about the contracture and the shrinking of police departments all over the state. So, Greg, what do you see? What kind of conversation needs to happen on a statewide level about that very problem?
I'm not sure, you know, how Lansing is responding to that, nor the governor. I mean, again, if I look at it as, you know, more of a citywide problem or cities wide problem, given, you know, the economic situation that we are in a slow recovery, I would even talk in terms of federal assistance to buttress law enforcement, which I know is not probably a popular idea, but I think in the way that you bail out GM or you bail out Wall Street, you could help to bail out Flint and Detroit as well.
And I sense, Mayor Walling, that would be a welcome development if it could ever happen.
Well, it sure would. And for us, we had the pleasure of actually hosting Vice President Biden in the fall of 2011, and part of the proposed American Jobs Act was a few billion dollars in new spending for the federal COPS program that does provide matching resources for local law enforcement officers, as well as the SAFER grant, which does the same for fire departments. And in light of the massacre in Connecticut more than a month ago, we've had a number of mayors have been talking about the federal government needing to reinstate the COPS in schools program, which was eliminated and provided those matching dollars for us to put officers in a proactive manner into our schools and build relationships with youth so that officers aren't showing up after crimes have been committed, but we're dedicating some resources to addressing those challenges on the front end.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're exploring the 2012 murder statistics for the big cities in the state of Michigan, talking with Dr. Greg Barrick, who's a professor of criminology and criminal justice at Eastern Michigan University, and also the mayor of the city of Flint, Mayor Dane Walling. Flint having seen 66 homicides last year, which matched the record number of killings in 2010. Mayor Walling, as you alluded to a few moments ago, you're part of this coalition called Mayors Against Illegal Guns. And certainly after the Sandy Hook massacre in Connecticut, your group has been pressuring President Obama to get moving on gun control reforms. And the report from Vice President Biden is due today. What do you want to hear?
Well, I support the key federal reforms that I believe will make every community in the country more safe. We need a universal background check. We need to ban the military-style assault weapons. And we need a specific federal law to address gun trafficking, which is, you know, guns moving back and forth across different states. In addition to that, as I mentioned, we're promoting the COPS in Schools program and hoping that the president will make a renewed commitment to try to get some funding for that program. Mayor Bernero and I in Lansing were talking about that yesterday and see the real need for that. There's also mental health and other social service dimensions to this that need to be addressed as part of a comprehensive solution. But that universal background check is absolutely the top priority. Law enforcement needs to know which guns are being bought and sold and where they're at in the community in order to be effective and doing their job. And I think all law-abiding citizens should be able to support that.
Greg, as a professor of criminology and criminal justice, this is certainly key to what you teach and what you know. How much do you believe these kinds of reforms will make a difference in homicide rates in Michigan? Will they keep criminals from getting guns?
Well, a certain number of homicides are going to occur, if you call those, you know, not crime related, just sort of emotion or passion mm-hmm. related. If you're talking about a culture of gun violence, if you're talking about gang violence, and if you're talking about where these rates are at the highest, they're involving youth between the ages of about 16 and 26. So you really need a full frontal assault on youth development from early on, youth diversion. You need programs of intervention, and clearly you need some alternative to the gang life.
Are the gangs being weakened? Is the gang problem less today in 2013, can I ask you both, than it was, let's say, in the 1990s, or even going back to the 70s, when Detroit on the east side was living in fear of the Coneonies and the BKs? So are we at a better position with gangs? Have we managed to make a dent?
In Flint, which is on this case all I can speak to, I don't have the research on other communities. What we face is a widespread, more decentralized series of neighborhood or informal gangs. There's at any given time there may be only one or two larger scale criminal enterprise gangs that we would have under active investigation as we work towards arrest and prosecution. And the U.S. Attorney's been actually a great partner in that for us. So our problem is much more widespread and dispersed, and gets to the point that Professor Barrick made about youth development and engaging youth and providing alternatives to the gang life. Some of that is with employment. Some of it is more social and recreational. That's where we see the real need and the opportunity to intervene.
Mayor Welling, you've grown up in Flint, so you really have tremendous perspective. Talk to us about your thoughts. How has crime in your city changed over your lifetime?
Well, it has become more widespread and more violent. It's certainly true that in the 1980s, with the major economic dislocations, when I was coming of age, we had our previous homicide records, but the city's population has dropped substantially since that time. So when we're looking at simply statistics year by year, and we're matching account and exceeding account in the 2011-2012 that we had previously 30 years ago with a larger population, it's become more prevalent and much more violent. The number of drive-by shootings, the number of incidents with gun violence is substantially up from where it would have been 20 or 30 years ago. Fortunately, is taking place is the great advances in medicine, and what's happening in our emergency rooms is frankly saving dozens of lives every year that otherwise would be being lost to gun violence.
That last point is very true. Medicine has reduced those rates, and that's hard to factor in. But if one does, then what the mayor is saying, that the violence, is at least constant. I mean, I go back over the long haul and I look at the national homicide rates for a moment, and they really have never been lower than 4. Unless you go back to the 19th century. So if we're at a 4.8 right now, and we were at 9 and 10 through the 80s and up to 91 or 92, I still see it as less, but I see it as beginning to expand again.
Why do you think it is, saying what you're saying, that we have less violence than, let's say, in the 1990s or the 1980s, so progress is being made, although you're worried about it going up again. But why do you think the violence feels just as intense today?
I mean, if I look at Detroit, they had 750 homicides if I go back 20 years ago. Clearly, the population has dwindled, but they have half that number today.
So the concentration,
But the rate is the same. Yeah. But your chances of being murdered in Detroit or Flint are about 8 times higher than other places where you would live in this state.
And that feels intense. And your thoughts, Mayor?
Yeah, I think what the professor said is right, that there's a certain intensity, there's a media coverage. No one lives in the world of statistics. They live in their neighborhood, they watch the news, they're talking with their friends and family, and there's a sense that at any point and at any time, in light of the recent mass killings, you could be at risk. And some of that, I believe, does have to do with the widespread availability of powerful assault weapons. And it was noted earlier about that gun industry. They're, in my view, unfortunately, looking for new markets and new consumers for their products, and that may make one individual person feel more safe, but there's a collective negative result of that marketing and availability of such high-powered weapons.
Professor, I'm curious, as you hear conversations within cities and within the state of Michigan and even nationally, what are some of the biggest misconceptions that you hear in these conversations about our crime and about our murder rates?
Probably the number one misconception is that violent crime in general is still going up or rising, when nationally and even here in Michigan, with the exception of this homicide that we're talking about, those rates are going down. So that would be probably what I hear.
Your thoughts, Mayor?
You know, I think that one of the challenges is this very difficult to understand bundle of issues around what drives crime, be it in a neighborhood or in a city. And, you know, you've heard me talk about levels of staffing and gun violence. We've talked about youth. There's all kinds of competing research out there. An article circulating, I think it was in the Atlantic, about the role of lead and lead poisoning and how that's affecting children's development in certain areas and creating a greater likelihood of committing a violent crime. So it's very difficult to have a comprehensive discussion because there's so many different perspectives about what really is driving the cause. I talk a lot about jobs as a mayor, and I have a belief that if more of our young people had a positive economic opportunity, that fewer of them may be involved in gangs. I don't know what a researcher would say about that who looks at, you know, a couple hundred cities across the country to say if that's really true or not. It's definitely something I hear from residents, but that combination of what the research will tell you, what you're hearing from residents and citizens, they often don't reconcile.
And we'll have to leave it there for now, but we really want to thank both of you for joining us today. Dane Walling is the mayor of the city of Flint, and Dr. Greg Barrick is the professor of criminology and criminal justice at Eastern Michigan University. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Governor Snyder delivers his third State of the State address tomorrow evening. Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll look at what we're likely to hear from the governor. You're listening to Stateside. Listening to Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. The 2013 North American International Auto Show is in full swing for the media of the world. The auto companies are now displaying their wares to reporters in advance of Friday's huge charity preview and then the public opening Saturday morning. Among the many reporters, presumably wearing very comfortable shoes to tromp around Cobo Center, are Tracy Samilton, who covers the auto industry for Michigan Radio, and from Edmunds.com, Michelle Krebs. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Well, you guys have had a couple of full days of auto show already. I'm kind of wondering, what is the overall feel of the show, especially when you consider it was just four short years ago? We were wondering how and if the U.S. auto industry would survive. Times have changed, haven't they, Michelle?
They certainly have. I think that we can describe the show as really upbeat. We're coming off a really good sales year. Everybody's anticipating this one will be even better. So really good mood at the show.
upbeat is good when you're relying on jobs to pay your rent and pay your mortgage in the auto industry in this town. Let me ask you this. Tracy, let me start with you. What have you seen that made you go, hey, this is good?
Well, I guess you have to start with the Corvette. That is going to be the car I think that everybody's going to want to see. It's maybe not going to make everybody happy. I thought it was beautiful, and it's really going to steal the show, I think. What do you think, Michelle?
Absolutely. It's the showstopper. Every time I stopped at the exhibit, it was packed with people, and I fully anticipate that will be the same for public days when they open on Saturday.
Well, that seventh generation Corvette is big news, and it's certainly a sacred nameplate to so many drivers. And fan reviews have been a little mixed on this with the black A-pillar and the totally new rear, but you guys both liked it.
I personally loved it.
I think it's beautiful. It looks different in different colors, and so there's a lot of debate about, you know, different parts of it. But I think overall it captures that is an American icon. And by the way, they brought back the Stingray name for it.
That's right. It's now back to being the Stingray. Michelle, things really got rolling at the show with the announcement of the North America 2013 Car and Truck of the Year, with the Cadillac ATS being Car of the Year. And that is, I believe, a first-time win for Cadillac and the fifth for GM. I'm wondering, how much does that award really matter in terms of sales for Cadillac? Is this more than just bragging rights?
I think it's pretty much bragging rights, but it's also, I'm on the jury, and so we really strive to pick a vehicle, and by the way, the Ram 1500 was the truck of the year, to pick vehicles that real consumers can buy. And I think it's interesting to note that those two vehicles came from companies that came through bankruptcy and the bailout, and both are made in Michigan.
And what does the win for the Ram 1500 tell us about the working relationship between Chrysler's team and their boss, Sergio Marchionne?
Well, I think it's been very interesting to watch what he's done. He is rearranging their product plan and putting money, big money, into refreshes of vehicles that really are not all that old. Those are vehicles that make the company a lot of money. The Ram 1500, they did a lot of work on. It's a great vehicle, but that vehicle generates a lot of profits for them. They are doing the same thing with the Jeep Grand Cherokee. That's a fairly new vehicle. They've freshened it up and put a lot of money into that, and that generates a lot of profits. So I think it's very clear on what his strategy is.
Tracy, you've found that Ford has kind of changed things up with their display this year, haven't they?
Yes, they have. Last year, they were really high tech. They had this big, almost amusement park ride that lifted you up in the air, and then you watched this elaborate video. And this year, because it's the 150th anniversary of the birth of Henry Ford, they've gone way back in time, and they have Henry Ford impersonators, different ages of Henry Ford. You know, the young inventor and the middle-aged Henry Ford and the older Henry Ford, and they will take you through the Ford exhibit and give you a tour from a script. They will not, you know, depart from the script and take questions.
Okay. You can't talk to Henry.
Well, you can talk to him, but yeah, if you ask him anything about the products, you know, they're not going to depart from the script.
But that's an intriguing thing. Is it working, do you think? Are people getting it?
Well, it'll be hard to tell until you see how the public reacts to it. If you've got lots of people just sort of bypassing Henry Ford, I really don't know at this point whether it's going to be one of the great draws of the auto show or not.
Let me ask both of you, what are you seeing that's noteworthy from the foreign car makers, Michelle?
Well, we're seeing Toyota showed a concept car that is to be the next generation Corolla. Now, that may not sound very sexy, but for Toyota, that is a really important vehicle. It's one of the best-selling vehicles, not only in the U.S., but in the world. And I think what I saw from Acura was the next iteration of the NSX sports car, which will go right up against the Corvette.
Tesla's Model X, their concept crossover, it seems to be kind of a boxing match against Cadillac's ELR, their luxury coupe. What do you think seeing these two?
Well, you know, Tesla's got a lot of halo and lots of praise. And I think the Cadillac's interesting because it's the Chevrolet Volt technology, and it's the one thing it does that Tesla doesn't do is it eliminates range anxiety. So I guess it depends on which way you want to go with that.
Yeah, and I suspect you're going to see a higher number of sales from the, some people are calling it the Voltalac, the Cadillac ELR. but, you know, we'll see about whether, I mean, these are really two very different vehicles, I think.
Well, it was interesting because in the coverage I saw today, it was Tesla's head guy said, we don't see any competition here. So it kind of does sound like it's game on, at least attitude-wise. The Ford Atlas is kind of looking at the future of the F-Series for Ford. I mean, we've talked already about the Ram 1500 pickup with Truck of the Year honors. Michelle, what are your thoughts on the future of the F-Series for Ford?
Well, I think the interesting thing here at the show is that there is a truck war looming. You know, we first had the Ram 1500 win the North American Truck of the Year award. We had General Motors show its new Chevrolet Silverado and GMC Sierra that go on this year, and Ford was not going to be outdone just because it's a little later introducing its new F-150. It introduced this concept truck this morning that looks like it ups the ante even more, and then the new production version will come out next year. So we're going to see some really interesting action in the truck segment.
And speaking of the glass house, of course, the big story in recent weeks, and I'm sure at this show, is Ford's desire to pump new life into the Lincoln brand. What are you seeing as far as what's being offered? What should we look for?
Well, last year we saw the Lincoln MKZ concept, and then that has gone on the market. This year they're showing the MKC, as in cat. It's a little luxury sport utility. My feeling about Lincoln, it's got a really long and rough road ahead of it to establish itself as a really credible luxury brand. But they're taking little steps.
Yeah, I think we need to see all four of these vehicles that they're promising before we can start to see whether they really can refurbish the brand. And I agree with Michelle. It's going to be really tough.
Can I just say as a consumer that the proliferation of letter names, SRX and ELR and MKZ and MKC, is it just me that has a hard time, you know, remembering what's what?
No.
Oh, no. Everybody gets confused.
You know, it's too bad we can't go back to just really good names, but naming vehicles is very difficult. And then also, vehicles are sold globally, so they have to have something that translates. And boy, there have been slips in time of, you know, I go back to the Chevy Nova, which in Spanish means no go. That's not a good name for a car.
Tracy Samilton, Michigan Radio's auto beat reporter, reporting down from the auto show. And of course, from Edmunds.com, Michelle Krebs. Keep those comfortable shoes on, ladies.
We need naps.
Thanks for reporting for us today.
Yeah, thanks.
Governor Snyder will deliver his third State of the State address tomorrow night, and he'll be speaking to a legislature, and one might infer a state, that is bitterly divided following the flood of lame duck activity that certainly put the governor in sync with the conservative voices in his party and greatly disappointed those who viewed him as a moderate. Bridge Magazine writer Peter Luke joins us now to look at what tomorrow's State of the State speech just might reveal about Governor Rick Snyder. Welcome, Peter.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, your story in Bridge raises such an interesting point. Remind us, if you will, of all the words and phrases we did not hear in Rick Snyder's State of the State address a year ago.
Guns, abortion, right to work, Medigap. I mean, a lot of stuff that really wasn't thought to be on the agenda until after it appeared after the election.
So what is said in the State of the State is not necessarily what's going to wind up on the agenda in Lansing through the year.
It did in his first year, not so much in his second year.
Yep.
Although he did get the personal property tax bill through in lame duck. That was a big piece of his agenda that he got through.
Yeah, you make the point that in his first state of the state, Governor Snyder got the Republicans to fall right in line with his agenda. And as you say, by the end of last year, it appears the reverse was true. So what are you expecting for 2013's speech?
Well, I think what he's going to call for is a lot of issues that he's talked about in the past through special messages to the legislature, but haven't come to fruition in terms of actual legislation. The main one being infrastructure. The last time the legislature raised the gas tax was 16 years ago in 1997. And since then, gasoline tax revenue is actually declining in real terms, not just adjusted for inflation. Vehicle registration fees haven't been climbing the way they have. And those two revenue sources make up the bulk of the state revenue sources for transportation. And so, you know, he's committed to raising more than $1.5 billion in new revenue that a transportation funding task force 4 years ago said was required just to maintain the existing system. How precisely he's going to raise that money, I think he's going to lay out tomorrow. The question is how much of it is going to be put on the burden of the registration fee as opposed to gas taxes.
You made a really good point. You were saying, you know, win some big fights and you're in the mood to win some more. And then you contrast that to the humiliation the Democrats suffered. And you kind of have to wonder, how will they get things done this year with that atmosphere?
Well, that's a really good question because, you know, he's going to need Democratic votes to do anything on transportation revenue. And right now, those votes simply are not there. You know, some of the labor business cooperation on that issue is, I'm not sure, is there anymore either. And so you're going to have a tight budget, which he presents next month. It's probably going to be pretty status quo. I think Republicans are going to find themselves in a position to pretty much have to put up all the votes for anything significant to get done.
Well, we certainly kind of got a taste of what's ahead when it came time to reelect Jay Spolger, Speaker of the House, which should have been a unanimous vote and wasn't. And he's saying, let's put the past behind us.
Yes, of course. That's what they bringing up the past does them no good. Mm. I think from the standpoint of the Democratic base, I don't think they want to put the past behind them right now at all, since that is a could prove to be a pretty powerful political motivator for them. In fact, there are some, you know, Democrats in the base who wonder why Jay Spolger got any votes at all from House Democrats.
Right, right. Oh, after these last 2 years, looking at the state of the state addresses and then what played out in the following year, do you think we know who the real Rick Snyder is?
I still think he's that, you know, that guy from the first term. Economics and the state's business climate are number one on his agenda. One of the things he didn't get last year that he wanted was the state implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, you look at his commitment to Detroit. I mean, a lot of that stuff got lost in lame duck is, you know, the transportation authority, the lighting authority. You know, I think there's going to be, to the extent there will be state funding required for this new vision for Detroit, I think he's amenable to that. He's done more for Detroit than any governor I can think of in the last three or four decades, in a lot of ways. And so, you know, the problem is he's leading a party that isn't as moderate as he is. And personally, I don't think he really wanted to sign the right to work bill. But, you know, I think he was told by a number of people in the Republican Party that this is a one in a generation opportunity, as that ad kind of pointed out, and he had better sign it. I don't know. I don't have any inside knowledge of that,
sure.
But he obviously said that wasn't his first priority.
And he had made a number of comments prior to it, sucking the air out of the room and not wanting to go there, which makes me wonder, looking to the year ahead, do you think, as you pointed out, the Republicans in the legislature had him falling in line, especially when it come to freedom to work or right to work, as you will. What do you see for this year ahead?
I think one of the interesting questions will be, there's a lot of seniors in this state who are going to be filling out their taxes in the next several weeks, and they're going to see that their tax bills went up thanks to changes that were made in 2011 for the 2012 tax year. So a lot of those changes aren't going to show up until they actually file their taxes. by April 15th. I think one of the questions will be whether or not Republicans get nervous about that and seek to roll back some of the tax increases they passed in 2011.
An unpleasant surprise, it isn't going to become apparent until people actually sit down and start filling out those returns.
Correct. But that throws the whole budget into turmoil, and I don't think they want to do that either.
It sounds like air turbulence ahead in the year to come, and we'll have to kind of see the reception after the State of the State tomorrow night. So who's going to be up there delivering that speech tomorrow night? Is one tough nerd still going to be himself?
I think he's going to come out and say, listen, the state is on the right track. The decisions we've made have been the right ones. And bear with me, I'm still the same person you elected with 58% of the vote in 2011. The question is, and that's how I conclude the column, whether or not there's still an audience for his brand of politics. And I think he has a fairly appealing brand that goes back a long ways in this state. And the question is, do people still buy that brand?
Particularly after the last couple months of 2012.
Correct.
Peter Luke, Bridge Magazine correspondent, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Oh, anytime.
And you can hear coverage of Governor Snyder's State of the State address beginning tomorrow night at 7, right here on Michigan Radio. You'll hear the governor's speech, you'll get the Democratic response, and of course, plenty of analysis of the evening. Again, live coverage beginning tomorrow night at 7 here on Michigan Radio. And let us know what you want to hear in tomorrow's address. What do you think the governor should focus on? We're on Facebook, just search for the word Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk tomorrow at 3 o'clock.